You have here in this picture designations of nations: Edom, Moab, Ammon, Egypt, Ethiopia, the Libyans, all of these things. Now I want you to think about this for just a moment. Nowhere in your prophecy do you have a movement of geographical location for a change of interpretation of symbols. Persia has ever remained Persia. Greece has ever remained Greece. Rome has ever remained Rome in geographical locations. Today we would like to pick up the king of the north and move him around on a chessboard. We'd like to move the king of the south around, as it were, on a chessboard. But they are still in the same location today as they were when they dropped out of the picture of Daniel 11 and now come back in again. For Moab, Egypt, and the Libyans and so forth, and that in location. But interestingly today, both the king of the south and the king of the north are Muslims. They all profess in that area the Muslim religion. And that brings it into play as far as the present is concerned. And you'll notice in the 44th verse, "And tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him." Out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. That means he gets no trouble from the south part, if you get your directions. East and north. But you also find that in the 41st verse, that he shall enter also into the glorious land. But tidings out of the north and out of the east shall trouble him. I'm not going to make any particular interpretation. I only call your attention to those as facts that are stated in the prophecy for you to consider as the prophecies of God's word continue to unfold in history. But notice the 45th verse. And this is the verse that when this event takes place, we know that we're at the end. "And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. He shall come to his end, and none shall help him." He shall come to his end, and none shall help him. He shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. That he is the king of verse 36. The king that the king of the north and the king of the south come against. And so therefore, that he being the papacy, the stage as this chapter closes is the entrance of the papacy into the glorious land, planting the tabernacles or the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. And yet a conflict between the papacy and the Mohammedan religion and the Arabs. That's the picture as far as the background of the wording is concerned, as holding to the fact the king of the north and the king of the south are not movable on a chessboard as too many of us are trying to move them around today. Now there's something else that I think that we need to take a note at, and I want to see if I've got it ahead. No, I guess I'll go back here. See where I've missed this or what I've seen here. Oh, yes. Plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. It doesn't say that they're going to move the eternal city. It doesn't say they're going to move the location. It's going to be only the tents of his palace, a transitory move between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Now, I would be remiss if I did not share with you papal designs. And I think some of you who are familiar with the documentation that we put out on various things will know and recall these particular things of the papal designs. I have here a copy of the United Nations Security Council report. And this particular report that I hold in my hands carries with it the triple crown and the cross keys, and underneath it, it says, "With the compliments of the permanent observer mission of the Holy See to the United Nations." This is the official document of the Catholic Church as it sets forth its position on Jerusalem. It says here, the attached letter dated June 30th, 1980, from the Charge of the Affairs of the Permanent Observer Mission of the Holy See to the United Nations was addressed to the President of the Security Council. In accordance with the request contained therein, this letter is circulated as a document of the United Nations Security Council. And in this particular document, let me read to you the objectives as far as the Papal See is concerned. The three religious communities of Jerusalem, the Christian, the Jewish, and the Muslim, are the primary subjects interested in the preservation of the sacred character of the city and should be partners in deciding their own future. Partners in deciding the future. No less than the monuments and holy places, the situation of these communities cannot fail to be a matter of concern for all. As regard the presence of the Christians, everyone is aware of the importance both in the past and still today, not only the Catholic community with its various rites, but also the Greek Orthodox, the Armenian, and the other Eastern communities, not forgetting the Anglican groups and others springing from the Reformation. Now here within Jerusalem are the forces. There's the Muslims, there's the Jews. But in the Christians there's the Greek Orthodox, the Armenian, and other Eastern communities, the Anglican groups, and certain Protestants. In other words, there is a volatile, almost a time bomb waiting to go off if ignited. Now let's go on. As early as its second session, the General Assembly of the United Nations approved on 29th of November 1947 a resolution on Palestine, of which the third part was devoted to Jerusalem. The resolution was confirmed in the next two sessions. On 11th of December 1948 and the 9th of December 1949, while on the 14th of April 1950, the Trusteeship Council approved a special statute for the city on the basis of the Assembly's decision. The solution proposed by the United Nations envisaged the setting up of a corpus separatum for Jerusalem and the surrounding area administered by a Trusteeship Council of the United Nations. And this, you can find, is one of the basic reasons why the Premier of Israel does not want a United Nations presence in any peace talks. And you cannot disassociate this from the story of Jerusalem. This territorial internationalization of Jerusalem was not, of course, put into effect because in 1948 conflict, the Arab side occupied the eastern zone of the city and the Israeli side the western. The position of the United Nations does not appear, at least as yet, to have been formally revoked. The General Assembly, as well as the Security Council, has repeatedly, beginning with the resolution of July 4, 1967, insisted on the invalidity of any measure taken to change the status of the city. Notice these dates. And notice the forces that are at play. You know, I can't understand how in our zeal to bring up and concoct all kinds of spin-off theories on prophecy, we ignore historical fact. The Holy See considers the safeguarding of the sacred and universal character of Jerusalem to be of such primary importance as to require any power that comes to exercise sovereignty over the Holy Land to assume the obligation to the three religious confessions spread throughout the world to protect not only the special character of the city, but also the rights connected on the basis of an appropriate juridical system guaranteed by a higher international body. Anybody occupying that city must in turn yield their sovereignty to Jerusalem to a higher international body. And that's the whole issue over the United Nations presence at a peace conference. In his address to President Carter, the Holy Father referred to the fact that the question of Jerusalem, quote, during these very days attracts the attention of the world in a special way. When was the Pope with Carter? 79 in the White House? And there followed 80? And as a result of all this and things, the Jews moved quickly and went from Tel Aviv into Jerusalem itself. The position of the two sides on the question of the sovereignty over Jerusalem are known to be very far apart. Any unilateral act tending to modify the status of the Holy City would be very serious. The Holy Father's hope is that the representatives of the nations will keep in mind the common monotheistic tradition of faith and succeed in finding the historical and present-day reality of Jerusalem, reasons for softening the bitterness and confrontation, and for promoting harmony among all those who call upon God. The aim will be to ensure that Jerusalem will no longer be an object of contention, but a place of encounter and brotherhood between the peoples and believers of the three religions, and a pledge of friendship between the peoples who see in Jerusalem something that is a part of their very soul. What's the call? Jerusalem, the center of a universal brotherhood and a thing by which peace can emanate to the whole world. What place are we called to in this very last picture of prophecy in Daniel 11? Glorious, holy mountain, and Daniel makes it clear he's talking about Jerusalem. Something to think about. Then why, O son, are we looking elsewhere? And if you're going to look elsewhere, you're not going to know about Daniel 12:1 when it's fulfilled either. All right, that's not all. This present Pope, John Paul II, in 1984, in relationship to the year of redemption when it closed, he issued his apostolic letter. And I have a copy of it with the official document pertaining thereto. Listen to what he says about it. Indeed, so far as she is the homeland, Jerusalem, of the hearts of all the spiritual descendants of Abraham, who hold her very dear, and the place where, according to faith, the created things of all earth encounter the infinite transcendence of God, Jerusalem stands out as a symbol of coming together, of union, and of universal peace for the human family. If the Pope leads the world to a peace conference, where is it going to center? What's his objective? What's his idea? And doesn't it say that he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain? I may not understand the verses before about Moab and Ammon and the Egypt and Libyans and so forth, but I can read the 45th verse. Notice further. The holy city, therefore, strongly urges peace for the whole human race, especially for those who worship the one great God, the merciful Father of the peoples. But it must be acknowledged that Jerusalem continues to be the cause of daily conflict, violence, and partisan reprisals. The situation and these considerations cause these words of the prophet to spring to the lips. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not rest until her vindication goes forth as brightness and her salvation as a burning torch. That's what the Pope wrote. I think of and long for the day on which we shall all be taught by God that we shall listen to His message of peace and reconciliation. I think of the day on which the Jews, Christians, and Muslims will meet each other in the city of Jerusalem with the same greeting of peace with which Christ greeted the disciples after the resurrection. Peace be unto you. If He plans to take the people of Jerusalem to be taught of God, you and I ought to know who's going to be there pretending to be God and will try to teach the people. And should there be any doubt as to the meaning when we have that evidence and set forth for us in the writings? Why are we so blind to this and hanging on to all of these theories that are going in rampant today on these chapters? Let's go on. As he claimed to the close of this letter, he says, "This peace proclaimed by Jesus in the name of the Father who is in heaven makes Jerusalem the living sign of the great ideal of unity, of brotherhood, and of agreement among peoples according to the illuminating words of the book of Isaiah. Many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that He may teach us His ways, that we may walk in His paths.'" Finally, we gladly impart our apostolic blessing. Isaiah, the second chapter, is there quoted as the objective, Jerusalem, and therefore the basis of peace. My Bible says simply that He shall plant the tabernacles of His palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet He shall come to His end and none shall help Him. And at that time shall Michael stand up. That great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, there shall be a time of trouble such as never was, since there was a nation at the same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. At this point we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and begin on the 12th chapter. 15 minutes. Let's turn to the 12th chapter. Notice the first verse. And at that time, at the time of the 45th verse, when he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, shall Michael stand up. Michael came in response to the prayer of Daniel and contended with the prince of Persia. Michael will stand up and contend with him who has come to reveal himself as God at Jerusalem, a false Messiah, and his vicegerent. Michael, every time the word is used and that description is given, is always emblematic of a great controversy. Check it out in Revelation 12. Check it out in Jude. Michael stands as the name of Christ in conflict with the enemy. Michael shall stand up. That great prince was standing for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. I confess that the very language of the middle of that verse, the time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even that same time, is the very language that Jesus used and is least quoted in Matthew concerning the eschatological discussion on the Mount of Olives. I can make no explanation as to why the parallelism is there, except that the times of the Middle Age persecution that came immediately, ended just a little before the great signs, very similar in extent and in nature as to this time of trouble that will be when Michael shall stand up, the time of Jacob's trouble. But it says, those shall be delivered who are found written in the book. It doesn't say books. It says book. And you know, because of our tradition and our adherence to tradition, we have not studied the scriptural picture of these books and book. And I would like to call your attention briefly to this particular aspect of the prophecy. You'll find in Daniel 7, as we've noted before, that when the judgment is set, what's opened? Books are opened. But now it says that those that are redeemed and are victorious, that Michael comes as his saints to bring into the kingdom, their name shall be found written in the book, not books. And it's only the name, nothing else. Because there's nothing else that we can stand on, and the only reason we can stand in the name is because we have been cleansed and purified in the name of Him who is our Savior. And we need to keep that in mind. But you see, this picture doesn't stop here of the book and books. In the book of Revelation, this is amplified. Turn to Revelation 20. There, in the judgment of the great white throne, which is the final aspect of the judgment that began when the Ancient of Days did sit, it says there in the 12th verse, and I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. Dead standing before God? Yes. Those that are not redeemed in the first resurrection are spoken of in Revelation as the dead. They have no life in them. They have no hope of life. They are dead. Even though they've been resurrected in the second resurrection, they're still considered as dead. Notice now it says, I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. In Daniel 7, the books were opened. And another book, singular, was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. If you want to be judged according to your works, you'll come up in the second resurrection. I don't want to be judged according to my works. For I have no works that merit eternal redemption. My righteousness ascendeth not, or even comes near the righteousness of God, by which is the standard. It says that He has appointed a day in which He will judge the world by that man whom He hath appointed, in that He raised him from the dead. If I am hid in Christ, I am judged by Christ, before the judgment seat of Christ, and knowing that my works are not sufficient or never can attain, because of His grace and merit, my name is kept in the book, the Lamb's book of life. And that's all. Friend, on the other side, there will not be a single testimony, there will not be a single glory in a single work that I have done. We won't. Worthy is the Lamb. Great and marvelous are Thy ways, Thou King of Saints. There's not going to be no plaques in heaven for this individual and all the writing down of all the things that he did, the great things that he did. No, there's only going to be one emblem there. And that'll be Christ with His blood pierced and with His nail-pierced hand. And that's all. We need to realize that and recognize that. It's the dead that are judged according to the works found in the books. Those works were never blotted out in the investigative judgment. They're still retained and they got to answer for them. And what happens to them? They cease to be. But those whose works are blotted out, and what value is a blotted out work? Their names are put in the Lamb's Book of Life. And we need to understand this relationship between Daniel and Revelation and the judgment and figure out where we're going to be and realizing that all the works that we can do, they count little. Jesus Himself told those individuals that wanted to know what the work of God was. What are the works of God that we might do His works? What does God require? Jesus said, "This is the work of God, that ye believe on Him whom He has sent." And that's the only basis. Now let's go back here to the 12th chapter. "And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall arise, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine in the bright as the brightness of His firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." It says, many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall arise. You and I know some of them. But it says many. It speaks to those that shall be wise shall shine at that time in the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn right many to righteousness as stars forever and ever. If you go back in the 11th chapter, it speaks of these wise. Over here in the 33rd and 34th verses of, 35th verses of Daniel 11. "And they that understand among the people shall instruct many." If you'll notice your margin on wise in the third verse of the 12th chapter, it says teachers. "And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. You notice here it doesn't talk about the persecutions of a specific time. It just says for a time. God's ones that were wise died both under the pagan and the papal. And so you have a full picture. Now Daniel was told to shut up the words and seal the book to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. "Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river and the other on the other side of the bank of the river." It's still the same vision, the same place of the 10th chapter. "And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished." Here is the first mention of that prophecy or the time period of Daniel 7:25. It was not mentioned in the 11th chapter. And now he that sweareth says that when this time period shall end, a time, times and a half a times that shall be accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. And this is the very setting of Daniel 7. Because you find there in the prophecy and in the explanation, back there in Daniel 7, in verses 21 and 22 of the prophecy, I beheld the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and the judgment was given to the saints of the Most High and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. There you have a succession of time. The Ancient of Days came, the judgment was rendered in their behalf, and the time came that they possessed the kingdom. Then when you come down to the 25th verse where it speaks of until a time and times and a dividing of times, but the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. And so this voice that stands, this man clothed in linen, is looking forward to the time when it's past, time, times, and half a time, until the judgment shall sit and take away his dominion. For as the man clothed in linen, he's going to make the final intercession for his people. Clothed in linen, remember, is the high priestly ministry. He appears at the beginning of this vision as a man clothed in linen, directing the attention of anyone who will study that the great focus of heaven, and should be the focus of all time, is upon the judgment. The hour of his judgment has come upon the 2300 days, their fulfillment, and the sanctuary truth. In other words, the very thing committed to this people, which we have betrayed. Heaven's interest is in the judgment, when the power of evil, which the forces of evil have been contending with, the great conflict is a long time. The conflict of the ages. And now this one standing there is looking to the time when that conflict will be over. Would to God that we would have the same longing in our heart for the conflict to end that he has. And this is the focus, the emphasis. And he says, and I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go thy way, Daniel. For the words are closed and sealed to the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wickedly shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Interestingly, this verse has echoes of Revelation 22, 22:14? Let me just quickly find Revelation 22. Eleven. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still. He that is filthy, let him be filthy still. He that is righteous, let him be righteous still. He that is holy, let him be holy still. In other words, the wicked shall do wickedly. No change. Character is set. Definitely then a close of probation. All things are put together. Now we come to a very, very interesting part of this chapter, and let's take a look at it and honestly view it. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 days. But go thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. The days that are mentioned that he will stand in his lot at the end of is the end of the 1335 days. That's the last figure that's given there. Now we come to a problem. Is this literal time or is this prophetic time? Well, the very fact that you begin the chapter, the vision, and Gabriel says, I'm going to tell you the truth, and he starts out very literally, and the whole thing has been literal thus far, and we're down at the time of the close of probation, and we're touching the very last things, it cannot be prophetic time. I do not expect, after probation's hour closes, to see another 1,335 years. But now there's something to think about here. There's two ways that we can look at this. We can see in this, if it's literal time and is carried out as indicated here, that this can be fulfilled at the time of the fulfillment of Daniel 11:45 when he plants the tabernacle of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. For if the abomination of desolation is the papacy, which is the second phase of the nondescript beast and so forth, your first phase, pagan Rome, as an abomination of desolation, also stood in the holy place in 70 AD. Thus, the papal phase in the fulfillment of Daniel 11:45 would stand in the holy place and thus fulfill that same specification. Now, this is one aspect of looking at it. We then could conclude, if that be the case, notice I'm saying if. I'm not dogmatic, I'm not speaking ex cathedra, I'm only suggesting that if this be the case, the time elements that are given here in these verses could be the lapse between 11:45 and 12:1. But interestingly, there's another aspect or another way to look at this. Nowhere, and I emphasize again, nowhere in the book of Revelation do you have the 1335 or the 1290 listed or spoken of. It's not in the book of Revelation. And when I turn to the first verse of the book of Revelation, I read a condition in that verse that governs the prophecies of that book. Turn with me to Revelation 1:1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. The book of Revelation contains only that which must come to pass. Indicative of the fact that there may be things that had been anticipated that due to certain changes would be altered, and only that which God has chosen now to fulfill will take place. Therefore, we cannot add or subtract from that which is given in the book of Revelation, lest we have added to us the plagues or our name taken out of the book. Now, what could this mean then, as far as the picture is concerned, and why not there? In fact, you have the 1260 days there. You have it repeated in 42 months and so forth. You have that there. And you have the 1,200, the 2,300 days there in the experience of the Revelation, the 10th chapter, in the open book, the eating of it, sweet in the mouth, bitter in the stomach. That's all there. But the 1290 and the 1335 are not there. But in its place, there are some very interesting time aspects. Remember now, if the picture is as the picture is indicated here, and we're down here to the very time of the close of probation and the final acts, then we are at the time of the fulfillment of Revelation 17 in parallel. Notice the time elements in Revelation 17 and 18. Revelation the 17th chapter and the 12th verse. And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. An hour, in contrast with a day, is a much restricted and limited period of time. Furthermore, in the 18th chapter, we find in the 10th verse where the merchants of the earth and the kings of the earth that have committed fornication with this woman, standing afar off of the fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come." Again, the emphasis on 1 hour, a very brief, limited period of time. Far less than 1290 and 1335 days. How can there be a justification of an alteration if one looks at it that way? God promised to cut his work short in righteousness. A short work will he make on the earth. And we need to also take into account that as far as God's dealings are concerned with ancient Israel, there was an altering of the divine purpose in the sense of ancient Israel. And those things of that particular period of the wilderness were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. And that we can expect at this hour an altering of the divine purpose. And therefore, if God intends to cut it short, I have no objection that that time of trouble be reduced mightily. And I thank God for his love in such a reduction, if that be the case. But I can see in all of this a very interesting play and counterplay as far as the events with Jerusalem are concerned. If he places the abomination of desolation in the holy place, whether it be rebuilt, whether it be in a rebuilt temple on the Temple Mount, or there at the Mosque of the Muslims, that sacrilege may create a reaction. Another possibility is that Israel will become very stubborn in their attitude toward Jerusalem. And they have definitely said they will not, under any circumstances, compromise that issue. What would happen then if the forces of the nations of the world would remove Israel from that place? You see, there's a lot of factors involved in this that absolutely can stun our thinking and our mind. But whatever the situation is, we find that as far as the picture is, that it has to do with the very last times, the very last things. And if the rapidity of Revelation 17, it becomes the actuality and it says it must come to pass, when we see these final events, how much time are you going to have to get ready? Can you alter the habits of your life today in 15 days? Well, that's a prophetic hour. Can you change your whole thing in that period of time and so be on the right side of the close of probation? That which is being done must be done now and not wait to some future time. We must now bring ourselves into harmony with God's will and purpose. May God help us to do so and understand. In fact, the real emphasis as far as the book of Daniel is concerned is not the construction of a time chart built around so many literal days and something going to happen here and right down the line and become so absorbed in the time chart that we forget all about what the wise are to be as teachers turning to righteousness. And the only way we can find the righteousness adequate for the hour is in the final atonement. Our minds need to be directed to the understanding and meaning of what the final atonement is all about. And that should be the emphasis, and that involves the study of Leviticus 16 that we did here. That involves a lot of things. It's going to involve a lot of altering of our thinking in order to become in harmony with God. The book of Daniel speaks to this hour. If it were better understood, there would be a revival in our own hearts and lives that would follow among those who really want the truth and will profess the truth. So may God help us to that end, is my prayer as I close this book.